First of all, I want to challenge you to think about, and actually it's your president that gave me this idea, when he talked about young children as the invisible members of a congregation. The questions that people ask are something like this. What can young children even learn? We know now, thanks to all of this brain development research that's going on, that they can learn a lot. And we'll talk about that more specifically in a few minutes. But there's another question that often gets asked. We baptize them, what else is there? If it doesn't get asked specifically, it gets thought. And this one is one of my concerns, because there is a lot more. There is a lot of what else. That's what we want to talk about today. Or people say something like, we'll wait until Sunday school. And one of the best-kept secrets from CPH is the Parents in Twos program, which is a Sunday school program for parents of two-year-olds to go with their children. And I talk at lots of places, and most people don't know this thing exists because we assume that Sunday school starts at 3. Why should we begin at birth? First of all, I think it's important to remember this is a baptismal perspective. We are a baptismal church. We are a church that practices infant baptism. Our theology really says that children are members. However, that's not often the practice. We don't treat them as members. Until about 3 years ago, my own congregation did not list children whose parents were not members on the congregational roster. We have a congregational members directory that comes out annually, and until about 3 years ago, if the parents weren't members, the kids weren't listed, even though they had been baptized there. They hadn't transferred anywhere else. So that means they're members. But they're invisible members quite often. As a congregation, we make a promise. We make a promise to support and engage in the nurture of young children as a continuation of what happened to them in baptism. And then the next week we forget that we made the promise. Well, I'm challenging all of us, and I will continue to do that, that we cannot ignore this promise that we have made, and we cannot make it unless we intend to keep it. It's an important promise that we make. Let me just digress for a minute and back to that invisible congregation members business. There's a statistic, and I quoted it last night, and since I saw shocked looks on people's faces, I thought, well, maybe I'd be able to tell you today, too. Statistically, in the LCMS and the ELCA, by the way, for the last 10 to 12 years, there is a statistic that says we baptize X number of children in a given year, and 3 years later, we enroll 51% as many in three-year-old Sunday school. Where did the other 49% go? This is not a fluke of just the last year or two. This is a statistic that has held steady for 12 years now. Now, it is not a cause and effect. Nobody's followed these kids. We don't know. And we don't even know if the statistic is worse than that, because there are other children that come in that weren't baptized Lutheran. And, of course, there are congregations that don't have three-year-old Sunday school. But I don't care what other excuses you find. It's not a happy statistic. And what makes it even worse is that 1 and 2 year olds, infants, do not leave by themselves. So if the kid is gone, the parents are gone. So we've lost a family. Or we never had them in the first place. And that's my biggest concern, is that I don't think we ever had them in the first place. And so if we are baptizing children, infants, only because it's expected, and then not following up on these kids and not keeping them, I think we have something that we better be concerned about. When does faith begin? I think it begins at baptism. We all think so, right? That's our theology. Okay, if faith begins at baptism, then it's not just a spiritual inoculation. You know, it's not just a booster shot. It's not just that vaccination that, you know, you give it and it's done. And yet that is how it's treated, especially in those 49%. We figure, oh, there's nothing else I can do for the next 3 years because that's the next time this congregation offers anything, is three-year-old Sunday school. So I guess there's nothing else to do. Wrong. There is lots to do. The question is, what else does need to happen? And we're not talking just about birth to three. I'm talking about childhood in general. But because of my concerns about what we don't do for birth to three and about the taking for grantedness of congregations in that age level, I am going to focus on that for just a bit. Let's talk for a minute about one of my heroes, John Westerhoff. John Westerhoff has given me some thoughts to think. He's given lots of us, and we use him, by the way, as the theoretical foundation for the work that we're doing on children in worship, where he talks about faith formation, faith instruction, and faith education. Those are the three types. He's a phenomenologist. He's not a developmentalist. He talks about faith as a phenomenon. He is an Episcopal. He's also a baptismal Christian. He talks, you know, he's very concerned about infant baptism and what we do post-baptism with young children. And he talks, he's got a couple of articles that talk about living into our baptism. What he means by that is that for the rest of our lives, we try to figure out what happened to us in baptism. Living into it. It's kind of what Luther talked about, too. And we'll talk particularly about formation. Formation is kind of an attitudinal, dispositional piece. It's the valuing of faith. It's the identity into a body of Christians. Formation is particularly critical in early childhood, which means the first 8 years of life. But it's also just as important for assimilation. Faith formation is what makes or breaks an evangelism program in a congregation, I believe. Because if we don't form these new members into Lutheran Christians, they don't have an identity that says, yes, I belong here. And so we have to, I think, be far more intentional about the this is how we do it's here, about building a sense of community, about building a sense of belonging, which is all formative and very important. Instruction, we know how to do. Luther started it with the catechism. There were catechisms even before that. But we know how to do that one, and we do it well. But if we don't have the formation to build it on, we're missing something. Education is something that some congregations do incredibly well and others don't, because education is the life application, and it's dealing with the issues of life from a biblical context. That's what Bible study is all about. Now, can I say, the first 8 years I'm going to deal with this, or the first 6 years I'm going to deal with this one, and then I'm going to deal with instruction, and then education comes post-high school? No, it doesn't work that way. They all happen all the time. You're doing all three, but you're focusing on one more at each of the age levels. There are still formation issues in elementary schools, but the instruction piece is the most important, and that's one of the things that Westerhoff actually says. You Lutherans know how to do that one better than many of the other churches. But we need to be focusing not only on that one, which we know how to do, but on the other two, which we don't do quite as well. And the one that I believe we do the least well is formation, because it just sort of happens. Yet one of the things that Westerhoff says about formation is that a key piece of it is intentionality. And so if we are accidental rather than intentional, we're not doing nearly as much as we could. And there are several other things that are involved, and I can't remember whether it's later in this thing yet, so I won't talk about it right now. But there are several things that are involved that are really important as a part of faith formation. But intentionality is the piece, congregationally, that we really have to be paying some attention to. In addition to that, he talks about the four the styles of faith, and he has four of them. Experiencing grace and caring love. That's a formative style. That's what happens in the formation stage. Affiliating with others in the family of faith. This sense of belongingness that I talked about a couple of minutes ago is a critical piece of that. Searching for personal answers. You begin to see that in confirmation class and in high school when kids are really searching to own this faith themselves. And owning and acknowledging one's beliefs is the last style of faith that he's talking about. These are not stages, these are styles, because he really resists talking about stages, for which I honor him, because I don't think you can talk about faith as a stage thing, since it's a phenomenon that begins at birth, and there you are. Beginning faith. There are a variety of things that are involved here that I think are absolutely critical, that are components of helping children understand the faith that began in them. And I want to distinguish between the two ways in which I use the word faith. One of them is faith is a gift from God. It simply comes down. It's given to us. None of us have done anything to earn it, deserve it, etc. But the other piece is, for the rest of our lives, we are in the sanctification process and becoming more aware of what happened to us at baptism. And so faith development is not that it becomes a better faith. It becomes a faith that I understand better. Because it doesn't matter. Faith is faith is faith. Yet at the same time, faith can get stronger. And it's not God who gets stronger, it's I who get stronger. And that's the important thing to remember. So from that perspective, we can talk about faith development. So what is involved in this development business? One thing is trust and trustworthiness. When I was in graduate school and I started studying Erickson, I thought, trust versus mistrust, first 18 months of life. What do you know? It's not just in the spiritual literature, it's not just a faith thing, but it's a social-emotional thing. Well, if it's that important from a social-emotional perspective that all the rest of our emotional health is built on it, isn't it also important for our faith? So what that says to me is that the first 18 months truly, truly matter for kids. Because that's where trust is built. And it's not just trust from a social-emotional, secular perspective, but it's trust from a faith perspective. And so the strength of my faith comes from the kind of trustworthiness in care that my parents had in my first 18 months. So you're not just taking care of the physical needs of a kid, you're taking care of the faith needs of a kid as you diaper and feed, etc., and comfort. Probably comfort more than anything else. An awareness of others is another one. Beginning faith also includes that by the time a child is 2 weeks old, they recognize, earlier than that, they recognize mom's voice over anybody else's, and they know when they're in mom's arms or in somebody else's, and some kids are more testy about that. But by the time they're 4 months old, they have a very clear understanding of otherness, of an other. And it is that understanding from a cognitive and social perspective that builds the foundation for a sense of God as the holy other. That's something that Fowler talks about. There's lots of other things that he talks about that I think he gets a little bit not right. But this one he has exactly right. Another piece is attachment and bonding. It is my favorite metaphor for faith. Bonding is what parents do when they glom onto this kid and say, it's mine. Grandparents do it too. I think grandparents are more aware that they do it, by the way. At least that's my personal experience. You really know they're yours. And nowadays, when grandparents get to meet this kid within the first couple of hours, you really do have an opportunity to bond beautifully with this little person. But then what a child does and spends the next 18 to 24 months doing is attaching to this parent who has already bonded. Faith comes down, understanding goes up. A bonding and attachment. So if you want to have a better understanding for what happens, how our faith develops, read some of the attachment literature, because I think it's a wonderful metaphor. Another piece is object permanence. To know that something exists even when I cannot see it. How can you know God if you don't have object permanence? This takes about 2.5 years to develop, and yet at the same time it develops mighty early. When our now 4.5-year-old grandson was born, he was an incredibly colicky kid, and he had a grandfather who had just retired, so Bob was the resident bailout babysitter when his mother was trying to go back to work or work from home, which was even harder. And Bob always has a shirt with a pocket in it, and there's always a pen in the pocket. So here's Aiden on this lap looking at Grandpa, and he learned very early to play with the pen. Well, one day Grandpa forgot the pen. This kid was 4 months old. It took a while before Grandpa and Mom figured out that they had to find a pen to put in the pocket to calm this kid down. What I think is absolutely intriguing is that 1.5 years later, when his cousin was the same age, I caught them one day in our living room. The two of them are on Grandpa's chest, and Aiden is teaching Aaron how to play with the pen in the pocket. Aiden is still not developmentally old enough to have figured all this out, according to the child development literature, because he's only, he was about 20 months old. And he's not supposed to have figured all of this out until 2.5. And Aaron is only 4 months old. But he's teaching him how to do pen-in-the-pocket play. Which means that he was remembering how he had done it 18 months earlier. And it's that kind of object permanence, that kind of play with, is it here or is it there, which is what peekaboo is built on, by the way. Is it there or not? Oh my goodness, it came back! Is what really is going on in the kid's mind. It's that that gives us a reliable sense that God is really there, even though we cannot see him. Parents, as you can see from all of the examples I've given you, parents and grandparents, significant caregivers, whoever they are. I would like it to be parents all the time, but it isn't. So we have to live with that, and we have to do the best we can. I think that, to me, is the rationale for child care in Lutheran churches. It's going to happen, so it might as well happen where we know what we're doing. But parents are really the role models for God's relationship with us. And so each of you, whether you know it or not, has taken pieces of your early experiences with your parents, with your grandparents, and used those to define God. When I tell the story of Jesus in blessing the children, and I'm not going to do it today because it takes too long, it's a very long story when I tell it, when I tell that story, I am not talking only about Jesus and the children. I discovered about 10 years ago that I'm really talking about Grandma Schmidt, my grandmother, and the garden that she had, which was twice as big as this room, by the way, and being welcomed into that garden and talked to and valued as a child. That's my metaphor for Jesus welcoming children. Now, only because of what I do I think about these things. So most of us don't really, we take this for granted. We don't think about these things. And so these memories, I've defined them and dredged them up, and they're really valid memories because I check with my siblings and I check with my mother to see if this is really true, and they all say, yeah, it's true. Did Grandma really have a bench that was about the same size as the rock that I think Jesus sat on? Yeah. My sister says she sat on it too. So it did exist. Was Jesus' rock that he sat on just exactly that big? I doubt it, but it's on my list of questions to ask when I get to heaven. We can also talk about building concepts, a sense of otherness which develops from that awareness of others, strengthens in middle childhood. Separation and individuation is another piece. Knowing that I am a separate person is an important foundation for knowing that God is there and I am here, but that he is caring for me. Children are also pre-logical and mystical in those early years, and there are ways. In fact, there's research now. We're doing a collaborative study in Senzed with the University of Ostrava in the Czech Republic. And there's two of the questions, on this child concepts of God thing that they're doing, which is the one that's translated that Grebner and Sohn did in various years. Some of you may have that 1960 book that Oliver Grebner wrote on child concepts of God when he did the original study. Anyhow, six-year-olds or first graders, they did first, third, and fifth grade, and the answers sort of dip in third grade and then go back up. And there are answers that first graders are giving to a couple of the questions that are far more mature than one would expect. But I think the explanation is that they don't need logic. They don't think logically. And so it sounds like a mature answer that really isn't a mature answer. It's just a pre-logical answer. And third graders are very logical, or trying to be. And so they sound like doubters. And then the fifth graders sounded a little bit more mature than that. Fascinating. Because when we first looked at it, we all said, huh, what's going on here? Deterioration? No, I don't think so. I think it's just that it's showing how pre-logical six-year-olds are. There are the beginnings of lots of theological concepts. Sin, grace, forgiveness, etc. Repetition and ritual become very, very important in these early years. In fact, they're important all the way through. Have you ever tried to put a kid to bed and not use the right bedtime ritual? Disastrous. Children also begin to identify with the faith story. In many ways, they are anthropomorphic. And if you ask children who are 6 and 7 year olds to do drawings about what God looks like, he's almost always an old man who has a smiling face. But they also begin to inquire and search, to ask questions. And this is what happens in the elementary years. In many ways, they're still mythic and literal, and I think we need to honor that, and pre-conventional. They don't understand all of our ideas about how it works. We need to take children where they are and not try and change their minds when it's developmentally impossible. I've already talked about formation versus the gift of faith, and I think that's an important process because we're talking really in faith development about the sanctification process. And probably the foundational piece of all of this is the trust versus mistrust piece. But another thing that I want to just mention for a moment is the assimilation of values that children do. Every three-year-old, when given choices that would indicate what a parent would prefer, gets it right. They already know what their parents' values are, and there has been no formal teaching of values. So if we were a little bit more intentional, think what we could do. We have to be really careful because kids figure out what our values are, not from what we say, but from what we do. And by three, they get it right. Unbelievable. Faith formation. Some of the ingredients that Westerhoff talks about are predictability. How predictable are you? How predictable is the worship liturgy? I think being a liturgical church has a dynamite impact on children's faith formation. In fact, when we started this children in worship stuff about 6 years ago now, six, seven, how long ago was that, John? Wow. Yeah. I thought, oh, you know, I'm not sure that this liturgical stuff is going to make all that much difference. Well, I'm here to tell you that I've changed my mind and gone from... I wasn't over here liturgically, but I was at least here. And I'm over here. I have really changed my mind because the kids are teaching me that it makes a bigger, much bigger difference than I realized. And my grandchildren are teaching me that. They do not worship in Lutheran churches regularly, but they worship there often enough with Grandma and Grandpa that they have figured out the predictability of our liturgy. And so when the pastor says, let us pray, Aiden says, Grandma, we got to get up. And what he really means is, put down the kneeler so that I can stand on it. He knows that. He's there every couple of months. And he gets it. Rituals. Are there rituals in worship? You betcha. Are there rituals in our homes? And the question is, are those rituals faith-related or not? Those of you that are preparing to work in congregations, one of the things I think pastors and congregational leaders can do is to help parents understand the power of ritual and the importance of spiritual rituals. Prayer. You try and skip prayer with a 3-year-old who has learned to pray in childcare or school. It's not going to happen. For both of our daughters' families, there is prayer before meals because the kids insist. Now, does that make me happy about my daughters' families? No. But it makes me happy about my grandsons. Because they get it. A little child really shall lead them. Another piece is intentionality. Does what happens that's good for kids happen accidentally or intentionally? As long as it's good for kids, it probably doesn't matter. But if we're intentional, we're going to do a whole lot more than if we're not intentional. I think that's what I'm really saying here. And the other piece is building a sense of trust. We don't need to talk about that one anymore. What are some of the building blocks of faith understanding? I think God's peace. I'm just going to give you a list. Not going to spend a long time on this. Being a dependable God, a universal God, omnipresence, a grace, God works through others, forgiveness, prayer, trustworthiness, predictability, security, love. These are all building blocks that tell us something about God or are, in fact, theological constructs. And they all begin in early childhood. Every one of them. What do children learn early? Well, let's look for a minute at early brain development. Brain development is one of the first things that happens fetally. The brain stem is the first thing that develops. By the time there are about 4 cells in this zygote, because that's what it's usually called. That doesn't sound so hot. This little kid. It's the brain stem that those cells are working on and becoming. So brain development begins early. At the same time, brain development takes the longest to get done because it's the most complex part of our body. And it really takes 4 years post-birth. And have you looked at a little kid recently? Their head, you know, their head is so much larger than the rest of their body. We'd have heads like this if we had the same proportion. That's why they have no balance in that first year, because their head is too big for them to hold up. Their body has to catch up with their head for them to be able to walk, because they just can't make it. So early development is very important. Now, fetally, did you know that a fetus can hear? Most of us, I think, now know that from some of the brain development stuff. And what's fascinating is we can do MRIs on fetuses, and we can figure out what part of the brain is lighting up when something happens. They feel pain, they hear, and they can remember. at 3 months gestationally, translated means 6 months before they're born, if they're born at normal time, this area right here in the brain is reasonably fully developed. This area holds the two things, hearing and memory. Why is this important? Sight wouldn't be important, right? Sight develops much later, like 6 months later, because you don't need it till you're born. But hearing, God is so amazing. I mean, this is really amazing when you think about it. Hearing develops here, and it's important because you hear, you recognize your mother's voice right after you're born because you've been hearing it for 6 months. And if you're lucky, you also heard your dad's voice. I got to take a minute to tell this story. I told myself I wasn't going to, but I will anyway. Aaron, who's our now almost 3-year-old grandson, before he was born, I asked his father, "Okay, Jay, are you talking to this kid?" And he said, "Sure, I'm reading to him." And I said, "What are you reading?" And he said, "Zeus in Utero." I said, "What? This really exists?" "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, it's a book. We bought it. Zeus in Utero. That is literally the title of the book." Brilliant marketing ploy, by the way, because it's got a little phrase from every Zeus book that ever was written. And so he's reading it to him every night. Well, Aaron was 6 days old. He's sitting in his other grandmother's lap. He's about as far from me away from me as Susie is right now. And they're having this conversation, and he's engaged with his other grandmother's face. And in between us is the coffee table, and on it is Zeus in Utero, which I have never seen before. Now, as an early childhood educator, you can't look at a book like that you've never seen before and not pick it up. And you can not only not do that, once you pick it up, you have to read it out loud, because what's the point of reading Zeus to yourself? So I started to read out loud. I didn't even realize I was doing this, and then all of a sudden, Aaron stopped looking at Rosalind, and he turned to me. And you could see there was a look of recognition in the eyes. You know that look when you see a baby. There's a look of recognition. What was he recognizing? My voice? No. The words. Now, I did a little research. I said, "Okay, Diane, have you read this to him since he was born?" "No." "Okay, Jay, have you read this to him since he was born?" "No." There is no other explanation than that he remembered the words pre-birth and recognized them post-birth. So I've got my own little example that this really does happen. So hearing and memory are there. So what it says to me is, we need to think about Bible stories and Sunday school songs pre-birth. We need Bible in utero, not Zeus in utero. I'm trying to convince CPH that that's a good idea. I really have. I've already submitted a book. They haven't bitten on it yet, though. Cause and effect. Children learn that incredibly early because their brains sort that out. And their early brain development is based on rituals and predictability. Remember, it's what Westerhoff says, and it's what all the brain development literature says, right together. So what happens in the brain? Neuron development is what really happens. That's what all this stem cell stuff is about, because that's what the stem cells do, is they shoot off these daughter cells, and they just keep shooting them off. It's not cell division. It's cell propagation. And these neurons then spend their time figuring out where they need to be, and they each have a specific place to go depending upon when they were born. From the neurons, you develop axons and dendrites, and that's the communication system that our brain cells use. Neurons is another word for brain cells. But, you know, the dendrites are out here catching all the words, all the information, and the axons are sending it on to the next one. It's the telegraph system in your brain. And they do that across a space that's called a synapse. The synapse isn't a thing. It's a space. In that space are hormones, however. And if you have too much cortisol from stress, it gets in the way of having the synapse do what it's supposed to do, because what actually your brain is sending is not little bits of information like words. It's sending electrical impulses. And those electrical impulses have to get through that synapse, and if there's too much cortisol in the way, they won't. What you need is things like serotonin, epinephrine. Those are things that we now put into people if they don't have enough of it. So when you talk about a chemical imbalance in the brain, which causes depression, it's because of those chemicals that ought to be in the synapses and aren't. And that stuff develops early. What we now know is that children at birth have the same number of synapses as you do sitting here right now. But over the next 4 years, those synapses go from 100 million to 400 million plus. Because what happens is, in that early stimulation, kids need all of these extra connections just in case they're going to use them. But after four, it goes back down to the adult level. But what that says is, it's those first 4 years when the brain is so ripe for stuff that we cannot ignore. And yet, remember what I said about invisible church members. At the best time of life, what does this have to do with faith? It's the same set of supports that supports brain development as faith development. Early intentionality matters, and adults are important. Okay, let's shift gears. Congregationally, we need to figure out how to better do support for families with young children. We need awareness of children in the congregation, including environment, programs, and intentionality. That's what our children in worship research is really all about, is figuring out whether we're doing those. That was the first study, which is in the book that's over there on the windowsill. We're working on another study that's looking more at what children are doing in worship and what they understand about worship. And stay tuned, we'll get those results out probably in 3 or 4 years. What else can we do? Kid faith training. Larry talked about that a minute ago, and I'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute. It is a project that has a 2-day seminar. I have some brochures over there. At my church, we have a kid faith committee. What that committee does is looks at everything. We're just sort of the nosy people in the congregation. What's happening in this place for kids, and which board do we need to talk to about it? So that in the process, we're assessing needs and resources, and also even developing resources, and saying, okay, if we do this, what's it going to mean for kids? You know, we usually think about what's it going to mean for adults. Maybe we think about families. But this committee asks, what is it going to mean for kids? It's a child impact mentality. Parishes can also do a baptism class. Do you realize in most congregations we spend 2 years on confirmation and a phone call on baptism? Something is wrong with this picture. Baptism is the entry into the family of God. It's a sacrament. Confirmation isn't even a sacrament, and we spend 2 years on it. Did you ever think about that? What we've done, what I've helped to do, is to create a class, a 4-week class. I haven't gotten anybody to agree that it needs to be required, however. That's the next step. Congregational sponsors. Put legs on the promise that the congregation makes at baptism. Assign a family, a couple, an individual to be the congregational representatives to that child and to that family. Ask them to promise to pray for that kid. Ask them to recognize baptism birthdays. Ask them to befriend that family. Do some baptism birthday recognitions. Pray for children, especially at their first baptism birthday, so they're not invisible. Think about Sunday morning classes. A Bible class for parents of young children. That Parents in Twos class that I talked about earlier. Either either during the week or on Sundays, do a Moms and Tots class. I think it's a better idea to do it during the week. This is parents of children under the age of 3 with, coming with their children. Tot Unto Jesus is a specific program that actually began in New Orleans, and it in some places it's the whole range from birth to 3. In other places, it's that first year of life. It's, again, a parent-child class. And then what about worship itself? Booster seats. There's no parent that would go to a restaurant that didn't have high chairs and booster seats. Why do we expect them to come to church without a place for their kid? Do you ever think about that? Kids can't see anything. Especially the 3-year-olds. They think they're too big to sit on a lap, but they're also too little to sit on the pew and see anything. The other piece of that is, don't relegate them to the last pews of the church. In our research, 4 congregations, which also turned out to be 4% because there were 100 congregations, had reserved places in the front of the church. 34 had reserved places in the back. And we also deduced that worship for most little kids is a spectator activity, but how can you spectate if you can't see? So put them in the front, give them a booster seat. Give them an activity bag. Give them a children's sermon that teaches them to listen for specific words for the name of God in the next sermon. And if you do children's sermon, don't call the next one the grown-up sermon. Because then you immediately are saying, you don't have to listen. We teach children in many places to be hungry during sermons because we give them Cheerios. I was accidentally, this is not intentionality, I was accidentally taught to listen to sermons. It's my name that did it. I came to my congregation, this is probably about 15 years ago, I walked in to the congregation that I was raised in, and I said to myself, you are in for a good listen. And I thought, now where did this thought come from? An early childhood educator has to figure that out. So I thought about it for a good long time, and I finally put together that comment with a memory that I had of standing in a pew next to an open window with my baby sister on my mother's lap. Now, she was less than a year old. She was probably 8 months old at the time. And her birthday's in December, mine's in September, and it was summer, so I was not quite 2. I stood there, and I waved at the pastor every time I heard my name. And finally, he didn't talk back to me, so I said, I'm here! I asked my mother, did this really happen? And she said, oh yeah, and it was a sermon on the Beatitudes. Now, why surely was in the Beatitudes 50 times that Sunday? I don't know. But it was. And so I learned to listen to sermons because you never know when you're going to hear your name. We need to be teaching all children. Not everybody has a name like Faith or Grace or Shirley. But every kid can listen for the name of God. And that's what we need to be doing, is helping children to know what to listen for. The last time we had Aiden in church, he poked me with his elbow. He was sitting in a booster seat between us. And he poked me with his elbow and he said God. And I said, yeah, listen, he'll probably say it again. It was one of those Sundays that nobody had said anything about words to listen for, but he gets it. And so he knows he's supposed to listen for the name of God in a sermon. I think that's wonderful. And I guess I did lean over maybe the time before that he was with us and said, Aiden, listen for the name of God. He's going to say it. A staff nursery. I think churches do need nurseries because there's this period between 18 months or sometimes 15 months and 2 or 2.5 when it's really tough to worship with a kid. Although I think the parent's job is to worship with the kid and teach them how to worship and coach them into worship. There's a point at which you just can't do it every Sunday. And if we really are trying to do outreach and welcome visitors, that's who's going to use the nursery. And that's actually happening. I've been asking the nursery staff. We pay them, by the way, and it's not a rotating, revolving door thing because that's a trust issue for me. I asked them. I said, who usually uses this? And they said, well, at least more than half of the people that are here are either new members or visitors. And I thought, aha, my theory is correct. Those are the ones who don't understand yet that kids belong in worship. Not to have a nursery then would be a stumbling block. And I don't want stumbling blocks for anybody to think about not being in worship. What's your response going to be? I think you need to learn about young children. Take a child development class. Find one. There's lots of good places in the St. Louis area to do that kind of thing. Be intentional about the newest members and think of them as members. Probably about 2-3 years ago, Bob asked me to read over the minutes from an elders meeting, it was a month that I knew who had been welcomed as new members, and he had something like 8 new members on this thing, and I said, hold it. The Millers have 5 kids. You didn't count them, and you don't have them listed. I made him change the minutes. And he gets it now. The kids are always listed. Bless and greet children by name. One of the most powerful things that a pastor can do is to use a child's name at the communion rail and tell them something personal and do it nose to nose. We have an associate pastor who was a teacher, and he squats down, and he's nose to nose with every one of those kids when he blesses them. It just gives me goosebumps to watch him do it because he understands how important that is, because he's in God's house, and he's the one that's dressed funny. So who is he? He's God to this little kid. Pastors represent God to little people more than anybody else. It's a scary thought, isn't it? Identify congregational leadership that will foster attention to child ministry. Looking at the child might be centered in Christ. I got to go fast because I'm spending too much time telling you stories. Harbored in hope. Becoming intentional faith communities with leaders united in purpose and dedicated to action. Find somebody in the pew that you can mobilize to do this kind of stuff. In Kid Faith, what we do is training for congregational teams that gives information and empowerment. I do brain development. My pediatrician friend does. I do faith development. She does brain development. And then by the time they leave after 2 days, they have an action plan to take back. I have 2 questions for you. The first one comes from John Westerhoff's first book, the title of which is Will Our Children Have Faith? The good news is it was just republished, I think 2 years ago. Will Our Children Have Faith was initially published in 1976. It was my introduction to this whole area. And the question that he asks is the culture supporting or compromising the faith development of our children? The message is it's compromising it. Think about it. The culture does not support what you're doing in the home, what we're doing in the parish. Another question is, are the family and the church doing all that they can to support optimal spiritual development of children? What used to happen accidentally 100 years ago has to be incredibly intentional today because of the culture. But another question, I don't know who wrote this book, but it's an intriguing title, taking off on Westerhoff's title, Will Our Faith Have Children? And in some places it won't, because there are no kids in the pews. Are our worship spaces and practices welcoming young children and their families? Because Generation X is looking for 2 things. Relationships, that's the formation stuff, and services for the kids. You don't have those 2 things, you don't have that family. You simply don't. They have made up their minds before they ever sit in the pew the first Sunday whether they're coming back. Has anybody greeted them? Is there any obvious planning for little kids? So in my opinion, you have the booster seats in the back whether they use them or not, because it says, we plan for kids to be here. It says there are services for kids. If there are booster seats, there are probably other things for my kids. Take a lesson from the business world. Where does McDonald's put its Playland? You think that's an accident? It's not an accident at all. Last time a couple of weeks ago, we took Aiden and Aaron to the circus, and Aiden says, I want to go to McDonald's with Playland. Not just any McDonald's, McDonald's with Playland. That's one word. Will our faith have children? Are parish programs inclusive of the needs of children? Child care for meetings? Did you ever think about that? Voters' meetings especially? Otherwise, people can't come. Bible classes that address parenting issues? Or put parenting issues in the context of Scripture. I teach a class like that, and every Sunday we open the Bible and dig into it in some way. But we may have started someplace totally different. A Kid Faith Committee or a Children in Worship Committee or some kind of a committee that cares about the child impact of congregational decisions. So the two questions are, will our children have faith, and will our faith have children? Now, I have one last thing, and it's a little poem. We are writing the gospel a chapter a day by the things that we do and the words that we say. People read what you write, whether faithless or true. So what is the gospel according to you? That's the question, because children read you before they read words. And that's what really matters. There's a little bit of time for questions, not enough, but I'll try. Thank you. Fantastic. See, the only lullabies that I heard as a child, and it was mostly my grandmother that rocked me, were Jesus Loves Me and I Am Jesus' Little Lamb. And those were the things that I used as lullabies with my own children, and also I'm using with my grandchildren. And I have developed my own grandma bedtime ritual that happens at my house. And it involves prayers, mostly songs. And so we sing these things. And so the 3- and 4-year-olds, they mostly listen, but they're getting to figure this out. Our 12-year-old granddaughter, we took with us to London last summer when I was speaking over there. And the summer before, she had said, Grandma, I can put myself to bed. And my comment was, Emily, you're never too big to be put to bed and to sing to God. And you know what she said? All the whole time that we were gone for a month. And she said, Grandma, I'm ready to go to bed now. Translated, let's get busy and do our singing ritual. I think it's one of the most powerful things that you can do. Before my mother-in-law died, she had dementia. It probably was not strictly Alzheimer's, but it acted like it. The last thing that she still knew was, I am Jesus' little lamb in German. That was the last thing that she still recognized. And I think it was, the message was, you know, I can't do anything else anymore, but I can still do this. And to me, that was one of the most powerful messages about how important this is. So pick a couple of songs, learn them, and use them. Brings me to another thing. If we're really doing worship right for kids, we will have a hymn of the month and teach it in Sunday school, teach it in day school, send the music and words home with parents so they can use it for devotions, and then sing it in church every Sunday for a month. You know who's going to like it the most? Little kids and old people, because those are the pre-literate and post-literate people in your congregation. And everything that works for little people works for the elderly in the congregation. It supports them too. The liturgy really got its start because most people couldn't read, and so you needed something highly predictable. We're in danger of losing it because we're depending on kids, on people to be able to read, so we change it every Sunday. Well, but we shouldn't be, because there are other reasons for it to be there, one of which is for children, but one of which is this ritual of this is how we do it, so that when we go from place to place, there's something familiar. But it also gives us this sense of belonging that is absolutely incredible. And I think singing does that more than anything else. So I'll put that on your list, Hymn of the Month. Anything? Yes. Absolutely, because they teach. They also, anything that teaches non-verbally is important. Now, these banners with too many words on them, I don't like, because they don't, I mean, banners in many places have replaced stained glass windows. I learned about Jesus the Good Shepherd from the Good Shepherd window in my church. There are no stained glass windows in the church that we worship in. None. Zero zip. There are banners. Now, I haven't told the lady who makes most of them that there need to be clear symbols for kids on them. Now, that's really not too bad. She does a pretty good job. But lots of times there are too many words. And this I learned from a colleague. This is another pediatrician friend, whose comment is, it is not important for a 2-year-old to know why the cross is important, but that the cross is important. Think about that. They need to know what we value, what's important. Later, they can parse out the meanings. But right now, they need to know that these things are important. Symbols for the Trinity, symbols for the Lamb of God, but crosses especially. And often when I do a children's sermon, I talk about something in the environment. I've set myself up for one during Christmas week because we're going to go visit the Christmas tree. And we're going to talk about why it's there. If nobody else does it, the kids don't find out why it's there. Because the truth of the matter is, I don't think all their parents know why it's there either. So I use, I'm teaching the kids. If parents listen in, that's just fine. But I think symbols are very important. Yes? Thank you! I think it consists of one concept. Let me tell you how I do it. I read the pericopes for that Sunday, and I sort of guess what the other sermon's going to be about. And I'm usually right! If you read those three, you have some notion of what it's going to be about. Not necessarily everything, but I pick out one concept, whether it's the one that the pastor's going to pick out or not, I don't care. But I pick out one concept, and it doesn't have to have an object lesson, but it has to have something that builds on experience. What I did, as I told you, I'm going to visit the Chrisman tree during Christmas week. What I did, I did the one for Reformation Sunday, and I thought, now what in the world? Am I going to bring the 95 Theses? No. What I brought was a stack of Bibles. And I talked about how Luther translated it so that everybody could read it and it was no longer chained to the altar. I talked about that only a little bit. But I brought all these different Bibles, starting with baby Bibles, toddler Bibles, preschool Bibles, and then brought the two that I use. One of them is the one that's beside my bed, and then I have this study Bible. And I made a comment about these have exactly the same words in them. And this one kid who was about six or so said, but they're not the same size. How come that one's so much bigger? And so he gave me an excuse to talk about the fact that it has all these extra things in it that help me understand what's there. And I thought, well, the kid's really listening. What was absolutely interesting was that for the next month, almost every Sunday, a parent or grandparent came to me and said, I'm thinking about buying a Bible for my kid for Christmas. What kind should I buy? So I've suddenly become the expert on children's Bibles. But what I do is there's one concept. And then from there, we talk about it, and I ask them questions, and sometimes you have to go with where they take it. And then I say, okay, in the next sermon, these are the words to listen for. We always get out our fingers. God's name goes on the first one. Then some action that probably will be talked about, or some adjective like love or noun, something like that goes on the second one, something that's going to probably be in the sermon quite often. And I have learned not to ask the pastors if this word is going to be there very often, because they know what the concept is, but they don't know which words they're using for the concept, so it hasn't worked to ask them. But if I'm not right in the first service, I change it for the second service. And sometimes, like for Transfiguration, I added the word mountain. Whatever it happens to be that I think is going to be there. Two words are enough. Three is absolutely maximum. And then we do a prayer, and I do an echo prayer. I say three or four words, and they say them. And it's always got to be words that they can understand, because you're praying as if you are the child. And then my final thing, sometimes I give them something to take with them, sometimes I don't. If I do, it is something that they can take and share. It's an evangelism strategy. Go tell somebody, go do something. Can you think of somebody that needs something? One Sunday I gave them Band-Aids because God was healing our hurts. And I said, I gave them an extra one to give to somebody else. One Sunday I was doing the baptism of Jesus. I gave that one away this year, though. And we met at the baptismal font, and I talked about, this is where you were baptized, or at least lots of you were. And when you were baptized, and parents came back with stories about how many times that had happened, wouldn't that be a powerful thing to do for bedtime? Actually, the idea comes from a friend who does it as a bedtime ritual with her children. I think it's phenomenal.
Would you join me in saying,